Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
BP is going to pay, the Gulf Coast is going to be cleaned up, and we are going to get a clean energy strategy. Not bad for a 20-minute speech from the president tonight. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by MassMutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 15th of June. Good to have you with us. The president's speech tonight actually ran about 18 minutes or so. Not long, as these kinds of things go, but he did pack a good amount into it. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale covered the speech for us. Hello, John.
Hello, Kai.
So how did he do? What did he say?
Well, he tried to seize the initiative to show that he's got a handle on what needs to be done and is doing it. He called it a battle plan. He announced new resources for states along the Gulf, including access to the National Guard. But, you know, a big part of taking command is getting tough with BP. And he talked about how he's going to meet with company executives tomorrow, even though that's only for the first time since the April 20th explosion of the drilling rig. But at that meeting, he said he'll require BP to set aside a multi-billion dollar escrow fund to pay restitution to the hard-hit business people in the Gulf.
This fund will not be controlled by BP. In order to ensure that all legitimate claims are paid out in a fair and timely manner, the account must and will be administered by an independent third party.
What about some of the criticism he's gotten, John, for that deepwater drilling moratorium he announced not too long ago? It's put people out of work, and it's not all that popular.
Yeah, he acknowledged the worry that this is just adding insult to injury. It's putting even more Gulf residents out of a job and harming a vital industry.
I know this creates difficulty for the people who work on these rigs, but for the sake of their safety and for the sake of the entire region, we need to know the facts before we allow deep water drilling to continue.
Two news items broke just before the president went on the air, John. The first, that estimates of the flow out of that thing are up to now as much as 2.5 million gallons a day. That's quite a boost. But also a new regulator for the Minerals Management Service, the one that does the contracts and the regulation of the oil drillers.
That's right. His name is Michael Bromwich. He's a former U.S. attorney and a former Department of Justice Inspector General. His task is going to be to take the recommendations from the National Commission that's investigating the causes of the leak and try to put some distance between the regulators and the regulated.
What about the one thing that might actually help this from happening again? The president talked about that, turning this nation to a cleaner energy strategy.
Yeah, there definitely will be some new drilling regulations and probably higher liability limits on the industry as a result of this spill. But connecting the dots to a more comprehensive energy strategy that's going to get enough support in Congress, if anything, it's become more of a problem. There had been that growing common ground on reducing the nation's dependence on fossil fuels while at the same time stepping up production of domestic oil and coal and nuclear power to attract enough votes to get it through Congress. But that coalition is no longer possible because of the growing opposition to drilling after this spill.
Mm-hmm. Politics and the oil spill. Also, tomorrow's a big day in Washington, John, right? The CEO of BP is going to be talking to the president.
That's right. The CEO and the chairman of the board, and they'll talk about that escrow fund.
John Dimsdale in Washington covering the president's speech tonight for us. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
BP had an extra little problem down in the Gulf this morning. The company says the ship that's collecting oil from the leaking well was actually hit by lightning. It started, quote, a small fire on board. Nobody was hurt, but they did actually have to stop collecting oil for about 5 hours or so in the middle of the day. On Capitol Hill this morning, meanwhile, at about the same time as that lightning strike, CEOs of some of the world's biggest oil companies were doing all they could to avoid being hit by congressional thunderbolts. They defended their commitment to safety and accountability, and they took every opportunity they could to blame BP for ignoring those same standards, as Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports.
Rex Tillerson, the dapper head of Exxon, summed up the rest of the industry's response to the BP spill in a cool reply to a congressional panel today.
We would not have drilled the well the way they did.
But in the course of questioning, it became clear that some of the companies have one thing in common. They've copied each other's disaster plan. Among other things, they cut marine life affected by Alaska's Valdez spill and pasted it onto the Gulf of Mexico, as Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey pointed out to a visibly embarrassed Rex Tillerson.
ExxonMobil's Gulf of Mexico oil spill response plan lists walruses under sensitive biological and human resources. As I am sure you know, there aren't any walruses in the Gulf of Mexico, and there have not been for 3 million years.
These carbon-copied disaster plans for 2009 also listed the phone number of a consultant who's been dead for 5 years. As Congressman Markey quipped, the only technology the companies seemed to be relying on in these plans was a Xerox machine. One question that seemed to go unanswered was, why do companies like BP, companies who make billions of dollars per quarter, cut safety corners to save a few million?
You have to remember that this is an industry that has always been a bit of a cowboy industry.
Richard Charter has observed the offshore industry for 3 decades as a senior advisor to defenders of wildlife.
You take a risk as a developer, and that risk involves, in many cases, going forward with your activity as cheaply as possible and maximizing your profit.
Charter says without complete reform of how the oil industry is regulated, we'll see a repeat of this catastrophe sometime down the road. I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Moving on now from oil to financial reform, Congress has entered what you might call the Wizard of Oz phase of the financial reform bill. That bit where the guy says, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, or whatever the line was. House and Senate negotiators have started meeting behind closed doors to hash out what is going to be in the final bill. And they might not be quite as tough, those provisions, as people had expected, especially on the big three credit rating agencies. Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's put overly rosy seals of approval on questionable bonds, and regulators have been pressuring them to be more honest with investors, except, apparently, when it comes to the risk that certain countries could go bankrupt. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports that European officials would rather not hear the bad news about their own credit worries.
You could call it revenge of the ratings agencies. European officials have accused them of helping conceal risky private lending. But yesterday, Moody's downgraded Greece's credit rating to junk. And now some of those very same critics are hopping mad that the ratings agencies are being so straightforward. MIT economist Simon Johnson finds it ironic.
If they don't downgrade you, they're going to be criticized for being slow to understand what's going on. And if they do downgrade you, they supposedly destabilize the situation.
In France today, the European Commission's finance chief blasted the Moody's downgrade as ill-timed. A German official called it unwarranted, and a Greek newspaper labeled it sabotage. But at Yale University, corporate law professor Jonathan Macy says they can't have it both ways.
They want the credit rating agencies to be an early warning system for problems, but only problems in the private sector. Problems in the public sector with sovereign debt, they want rating agencies to keep quiet about and to keep ratings artificially high so these governments can raise money more cheaply for themselves, despite that they're incredibly irresponsible from a fiscal point of view.
European officials warned today they could revive the debate over regulating the agencies. That bothers MIT's Simon Johnson, even though he's been an outspoken critic of their role in the financial meltdown.
I think the credit rating agencies definitely need a hard look, particularly with their role vis-a-vis the too big to fail banks. But the European Commission is engaged in intimidation at this stage, and they should just stop doing that. That's quite inappropriate.
For its part, Moody's says its downgrade was justified by lingering questions about the Greek government's ability to pay its heavy debt. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here we are of a Tuesday, mid-June, and Wall Street didn't have a care in the world. Details, numbers, when we do them. This is going to sound like I'm trying to be cute, but I'm really not. The home building industry is depressed. The National Association of Home Builders monthly index of builder confidence came out today. Not so good. It's down to where it was in February, back before we heard those faint rumors about housing just maybe having turned itself around. Now that that homebuyer's tax credit has expired, builders don't seem to think that people are going to want to buy houses anymore. So we asked Marketplace's Brett Neely to explore how important that credit was, or maybe wasn't.
Almost 1 in 6 homebuyers this year will take advantage of the tax credit. That's according to rough estimates from the National Association of Realtors. First-time buyers got an $8,000 credit, while everyone else got $6,500. Was it worth it? Nicholas Ritsinas is a housing expert at Harvard University.
The measure is, did it help stabilize the market? Did it stop the free fall? I think in large measure it did. Now, it was an expensive way to do that. You know, it cost over $12 billion.
Expensive because some of those buyers probably would have bought a house without the tax credit. In fact, the credit's biggest impact may have had to do with timing, says Conrad DeQuadros at RDQ Economics.
If you're going to buy a home at any time over the next several months, you're incentivized to bring that decision forward and take advantage of the tax credit.
Now it's time for the hangover. Applications for new mortgages are falling, as are other indicators of the housing market. The government can't prop up home sales forever, says DeQuadros.
At some point, housing activity is going to have to be driven by the normal fundamentals.
Like job and income growth. Harvard's Nicholas Ritsinas says this economic recovery won't look like past ones.
Past recessions have often ended with new home building, and those construction jobs have pulled it forward. I think given the new variable of large numbers of foreclosures, I don't think that the recovery is going to be on the back of the home building industry this time.
In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
You know the credit crisis we've been dealing with the past couple of years? Banks not really lending to each other, never mind cracking down on mortgages and student loans. Well, that really only applies at the middle and upper ranges of the income spectrum. For the working poor, or for anybody really, who's got a decent job, but who's just a little bit short waiting for their next paycheck, there's cash to be had all over the place. For a price, of course. Payday lending is everywhere, and it is oh so nicely profitable. Gary Rivlin writes about the business of making money off the poor in his new book, Broke USA. Gary, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
How do we go from, in this country, you know, the every now and then mom and pop check cashing shop to, in some places, in some cities in this country, they're on every corner?
Check cashing dates back to the 1930s, but today, there's no less than 7 publicly traded companies that are in the check cashing business. Payday lending, which didn't even exist 20 years ago, there's now 6 publicly traded companies in the payday lending business. And so they started competing with each other. They had a lot of funding. Big banks loaned them money. And by 2006, there were 24,000 payday lenders, which is more than the combined number of McDonald's and Burger Kings in the country.
Hmm. Help me with the business model, though. If their customers have so little money, where's the profit margin?
Well, it's a nickel and dime business, but the good news for those who are in it is there's lots of nickels and dimes.
You have this anecdote, actually, where you're talking to the guy who I think you call the father of payday lending, and he basically makes that argument, and then you pull out your calculator.
Well, actually, I asked him to borrow his calculator. So we're sitting at lunch.
Remind us of this guy's name. Tell us who he is.
Alan Jones.
Right.
I met with him for a couple of days in Cleveland, Tennessee, and he starts taking the amount of money his company is making and dividing it per store, per week, per hour, and he shows me, like, look, I'm only making just under $8 per hour in a store. That's minimum wage. And I say, can I borrow your calculator? and he had told me he has 1,200 stores, so I start multiplying, you know, 52 weeks and 1,200 stores. And it turns out that he's bringing in around $22, $23 million in after-tax profit a year.
We had a commentator on the broadcast maybe, I don't know, 2 months ago as financial reform legislation was just getting started. And he defended his interest and he said, you know, we are not the bad guys. We provide a service. And while we certainly got a share of letters from listeners that said payday lenders are terrible and horrible, we got far more than I would have expected from people who said he does provide a service. I need this kind of thing. Leave him alone.
So let me give the payday lender argument. They're not holding a gun to anyone's head. Yeah. It's transparent. You walk into most stores, and it is posted on the wall. We charge $15 for every $100 you borrow for 2 weeks, and that works out to an annual percentage rate of 390%. The problem with the payday loan is the person who's so desperate today that they're borrowing money at that kind of rate, 2 weeks from now, how are they going to have the extra money to pay back the borrowed amount plus the fee?
Describe the tactics these guys use. You tell about store managers who are under immense pressure to reach out to previous customers to make sure they come back in, to get them going again. I mean, it's a hard sell.
There are some chains that have set up their computers so they automatically spit out the names of the people every day who haven't been in at least 60 days. And the store managers are under pressure to call those people. There's the upsell. I come in, I ask for $200, but I make enough money that I could borrow $500. They're going to have their people ask, like, oh, are you sure you don't want to borrow $500? You know, you qualify for $500. And so, you know, suddenly their argument of, well, we're just here when people need us, evaporates.
Broke USA is the most recent book from Gary Rivlin. Gary, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up, is Spain going to be Greece 2.0?
In Spain, what happens is they have such a rigid labor market that the minute a crisis hits, they begin destroying jobs faster than any other country on the planet.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials racked up 213 points today, more than 2%, closed at 10,404. The NASDAQ up 61 points, about 2.75%, 2305 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 25 points, 2.33%, broke the tape at 1115. Boeing stock lofted more than 4% today after the airplane maker said it was boosting production. Reports of an expected increase in computer demand powered shares of Intel up almost 3%. Apple and AT&T stock also got a bounce despite problems with orders for the new iPhone. Apple jumped more than 2%. AT&T popped up 1.5%. Meanwhile, big oil might have been on the hot seat in Congress today, but investors had their eye on hot oil prices instead. A barrel of benchmark crude added nearly $2. BP rose 2.33% in U.S. trading today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.32%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for the month of May. The Federal Reserve releases its monthly report on industrial production. And a House Committee on Aviation holds a hearing on the proposed United Continental Airlines merger. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You either hate Starbucks or you love it. You refuse to be sucked into a giant corporate money-making machine that gets $4 for a cup of coffee, or you appreciate a caffeinated beverage well-made. There are merits to both sides, but Starbucks is doing all it can to change minds. This summer, the coffee shops that are everywhere are also going to become free wireless hotspots. All 7,600 U.S. stores are going to stop charging for internet access on July the 1st. McDonald's did the same thing a number of months ago, making fast food the next best thing we have to a national wireless network. Jeff Horwich hooks us up.
Starbucks, lunch hour, downtown St. Paul, Minnesota. Three people are having a business meeting, no computer, by the way,
Where the heck is everybody? A barista says maybe try the coffee shop next door, where there's free Wi-Fi.
I think it should be free to customers.
Sure enough, Dunn Brothers Coffee has had free Wi-Fi for years. And there's Michael Hartford, a software developer who pretty much lives from hotspot to hotspot.
There's a little bit of noise around. It helps me to concentrate. There's coffee close by.
So he must be excited about the Starbucks Wi-Fi news.
They've really, over the last few years, become the fast food of coffee. I wouldn't normally choose to sit down at a Starbucks.
So if you're somewhere and there's nothing but a Starbucks nearby, and now the Wi-Fi is free.
In the Wi-Fi, I'll go to the Starbucks.
That's a corporate victory right there.
I guess.
But Starbucks is hardly the only option. McDonald's has free Wi-Fi. So Starbucks is throwing in free access to some stuff you'd otherwise have to pay for, like articles from the Wall Street Journal or TV shows from iTunes. That special house blend of Starbucks content rolls out in the fall. Starbucks says it will be ad-free to start, but Elliot Van Buskirk of Wired expects that's likely to change.
You're going to presumably be seeing ads within this content network. So really, suddenly it's not such a bad thing maybe for Starbucks to have people loitering around using their Wi-Fi connection.
But it's still all about the coffee. Sure, Starbucks can lead computer users to Wi-Fi, but can it make them drink? I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
You really need to know your Christian calendar to understand today's European debt crisis news. Spain's biggest labor unions have called a general strike for September 29th. They're probably giving themselves as much lead time as they can to help drum up support, but the date is also heavy on symbolism. The 29th of September is the Christian holiday of Michaelmas, otherwise known as the Feast of St. Michael the Archangel, famous for his biblical defeat of Lucifer. Organized labor in Spain may have a less epic battle on its hands, but workers are doing all they can to protest plans to change Spanish labor laws. Last week, they struck over another issue, looming government budget cuts. You roll in the denials that Spain's going to need a bailout, just like they denied Greece was going to need a bailout right up until it got a bailout. And the European debt crisis seems to be taking one step forward, two steps back. So we are going to spend some time the next couple of days on Europe and its problems. And we begin in the Spanish capital, Madrid, with Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
A group of men, some dressed comically as bullfighters, have thrown a party on the Gran Vía, Madrid's main shopping street. Doesn't sound like a city in recession, but there is an undertow of anxiety here. Away from the fiesta, one of the revelers, Alejandro Gómez, admits he's worried about his business.
I have a restaurant in the suburb of Valdemoro, and we are feeling the downturn. Because of the collapse of the construction industry, we are getting fewer customers.
Less than a mile away, there's another restaurant where business is booming. No shortage of customers here. They line up in their dozens every day and present their free meal ticket to be clipped at the door. This is one of 14 free restaurants set up here to feed the needy. Joaquin Calvo of the Catholic charity Caritas.
The number of people coming for food have increased by 80%. We are full. I mean, we are not able to do anything more.
The financial crisis hit Spain hard. Construction forms a bigger part of the economy here than elsewhere. When the real estate market crashed, the country was left with a massive burden of debt, and then unemployment really took off.
In Spain, what happens is they have such a rigid labor market that the minute a crisis hits, they begin destroying jobs faster than any other country on the planet.
Gail Allard, professor of economics at the IE Business School in Madrid. She says two-thirds of Spanish workers enjoy exceptional job protection. It can be very expensive for employers to fire them, and that makes the one-third on temporary contracts highly vulnerable.
The minute crisis hits, what they do is liquidate temporary workers as fast as they can before they pass this threshold where they become permanent and they become expensive to fire.
Since 2007, unemployment has shot up to 20%. With income tax revenues slumping and welfare payments soaring, the budget deficit has also taken off. Along with Greece and Portugal, Spain has incurred the wrath of its Eurozone partners. Who's to blame? Partly a dead and discredited figure from Spanish history. General Franco, the dictator who ruled Spain. When he died in 1975, he bequeathed the country a rigid paternalistic labor code. Professor Javier Diaz Jimenez is with the IESE Business School.
Part of what kept his regime going for 40 years was a very sheltered labor market. People were not fired. So workers were guaranteed a job for life. And in return, of course, we didn't have any political freedoms.
Back on the Gran Vía, reveler Alejandro Gómez sings a nationalist song about blood and the flag. It's completely out of tune with modern Spain. Spaniards are the least nationalistic Europeans, happy to surrender sovereignty to the European Union and to give up their currency too. For them, EU membership means democracy. Many seem alarmed that their future in the Eurozone may now be at risk.
Newspapers are saying that the European Union is thinking about taking away the euro from Spain, Greece and Portugal. And we are afraid, because without the euro, Spain is nothing.
But that faith in the euro may be sorely tested. Spain's European partners have pressured it to make painful cuts in public spending and to shake up the labor law. Unions have promised a general strike. Will Spain one day decide the eurozone is just another sort of tyranny? In Madrid, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, a very touchy way to look at the oil leak in the Gulf, courtesy of a research report out of JPMorgan Chase. Their analysis shows that for all the damage along the Gulf Coast, and they do acknowledge that, the report says the leak won't really hurt gross domestic product much, might even increase it slightly in the short term. But here's another take on what that report really tells you, that for all the attention paid to GDP by the economic press, present company included, it's a really blunt and not at all subtle way to look at something as complicated as the American economy. So we'll try to remember that next time that number comes out. But for now, that is Marketplace this Tuesday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow racked up 213 points, more than 2%, closed at 10,404. The NASDAQ up 61 points, about 2.75%, ended at 2305. The S&P 500 added 25 points, 2.75%, 1115, the number there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you ought to tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, fishing and oil usually get along in the Gulf.
They swap fish for diesel sometimes, you know, stuff like that, you know what I mean? So it's one hand washes the other, you know.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.